Hey everyone, welcome back. You wanted to deep dive into Chronicles, and wow, there's more to it than meets the eye. It's way more than just a list of names. So we're going to take a look at all the research you sent in and see what we can uncover together. It's fascinating stuff. Really get ready to discover how genealogies are like these historical puzzles with hidden messages, the significance of the number 70 in the ancient world, and how one king might have used Chronicles to rewrite his own legacy. It's a really fascinating book.
It really is full of surprises. One of the fascinating things about Chronicles is that the author wasn't just writing for anyone you know. He was writing for a very specific audience, a small, somewhat embattled community in Yehud, ancient Judea. And they were surrounded by nations that weren't exactly friendly, right? This community was really struggling to define their identity. And so Chronicles steps in to answer this really burning question: who are we and why do we matter?
I have to admit, I always kind of thought those long genealogies at the beginning of Chronicles were, well, a bit dry, But are you saying there's more to them?
Absolutely. The first nine chapters are almost entirely genealogies. The chronicler was incredibly clever with them. He wasn't just listing names, he was tracing the lineage of Israel all the way back to the very beginning of humanity.
Wow.
It's like he was embedding them in this vast historical narrative.
So it's more than just a family tree.
Right.
It's like he's saying, look, we're part of something much bigger, something that goes all the way back to the dawn of time.
Exactly. And remember, he assumed his readers already knew the stories behind the names. So it's like he was dropping these familiar names as a way of saying, hey, we share a common history, a common heritage. And it wasn't just about listing ancestors, it was about reminding them of their shared identity.
Right. And this brings to mind a fascinating example. Samuel. In the book of Samuel, he's an Ephraimite, but in Chronicles, he's a Levite. That seems like a pretty big discrepancy. Was the chronicler trying to pull a fast one on us?
Not necessarily. Instead of a contradiction, this might have been a deliberate choice. You see, in Chronicles, Samuel's role as a priest and his connection to the temple are really emphasized. By making him a Levite, a member of the priestly tribe, the chronicler subtly elevates his status within the temple hierarchy. This wasn't just about getting the facts straight. It was about sending a powerful message to the community in Yehud. It was about reinforcing this idea that their legitimacy stemmed from a direct connection to the priestly lineage.
So the chronicler is shaping the narrative to fit his message. He's highlighting the aspects of Samuel's life that reinforce the importance of the priesthood for this community in Yehud, especially at a time when they're really trying to assert their religious authority.
That's a great way to put it.
Now let's move on to another intriguing detail that you mentioned. In Genesis 10, there's a list of 70 nations that emerge after the flood. It's exactly 70. Does that seem a little curious to you? What's the significance of that number?
Well, that's where it gets really interesting. In the ancient world, the number 70 represented completeness and divine order. It echoed the 7 days of creation, suggesting this connection to God's plan for the world.
I see where you're going with this. If the number 70 represents completeness, and there are 70 nations descended from Noah, what does that tell us about Israel's place in the world?
The chronicler is subtly arguing that Israel has a divinely ordained place among the nations. He's weaving together these numerical connections to emphasize Israel's importance, and he even brings in Deuteronomy 32:8 to support this idea. In that passage, God divides the nations according to the number of the sons of Israel.
And how many sons of Israel were there?
70, of course. The chronicler doesn't explicitly state this connection, but he doesn't have to. His audience would have been familiar with these scriptural references. He's planting these numerical clues like breadcrumbs, knowing that his readers will pick up on their significance. It's like a hidden code waiting to be deciphered.
Yeah, it's like he's saying, look, it's all right here in the scriptures. We are part of God's plan. We are woven into the very fabric of creation. I'm starting to see how the chronicler uses these subtle details to build a powerful argument.
And once he's established Israel's place in the world, then he turns his attention to two key figures in Israel's history. Can you guess who?
I'm going to go with the classic duo, David and Solomon.
You got it. The chronicler focuses on their roles in establishing the Davidic dynasty and building the temple in Jerusalem.
Which plays a huge role in Chronicles. But it's interesting that the chronicler completely ignores the northern kingdom of Israel. Why do you think he does that?
Remember, he's writing for a community in Yehud, the southern kingdom. By this point in history, the northern and southern kingdoms had been divided for centuries. The community in Yehud saw their identity as distinct from the north. So for them, the story of the Northern Kingdom wasn't relevant to their understanding of who they were.
It's like he's intentionally narrowing the focus.
Uh-huh.
To highlight the lineage and traditions that matter most to his audience, he's crafting a narrative that speaks directly to their experiences and aspirations.
Now let's talk about a king who gets a surprising amount of attention in Chronicles. King Hezekiah. He actually gets more space than almost any other king, even more than in the Book of Kings. What do you make of that?
That is surprising. Why would the chronicler devote so much space to Hezekiah? Is he trying to rewrite history?
It's a question that scholars have debated for centuries, but one thing is clear. Chronicles presents Hezekiah as a model king.
Okay.
Highlighting his religious reforms and his efforts to restore the temple after a period of decline. You could even say that he's presented as a kind of second Solomon.
So Hezekiah becomes a symbol of hope and restoration for the chronicler's audience.
Exactly. And this emphasis on Hezekiah's restoration of the temple tells us something crucial about the chronicler's message. For him, the temple wasn't just a building.
It was the very heart of Israel, the embodiment of God's presence among his people.
Yes. And for the community in Yehud struggling to maintain their identity and their faith in a world that had turned upside down, the temple represented a beacon of hope, a symbol of continuity, and a powerful reminder of God's enduring promises.
Wow, I'm already seeing Chronicles in a whole new light. It's amazing how a book that seems so focused on the past can be so relevant to the present. It really makes you think about the stories and genealogies that shape our own sense of identity and belonging. But before we go too far down that road, I'm curious to learn more about the chronicler's use of genealogies. One of the articles you sent mentions that he uses something called linear genealogies, which are basically just lists of descendants. Why would he do that?
That's a great question, and it speaks to the different ways the chronicler uses genealogies to shape his narrative. Linear genealogies are incredibly efficient. He can cover centuries of history in just a few verses. It's like fast-forwarding through time to get to the part he really wants to emphasize. He can highlight key figures or transitions without getting bogged down in too many details.
So it's not just about listing every single person. It's about creating a specific flow.
Right.
A sense of momentum toward a particular goal.
Exactly. And remember, the chronicler's audience would have been familiar with the stories behind these names. So he could evoke a whole world of meaning with just a few words.
That's fascinating. It's like he's dropping breadcrumbs for the reader to follow, knowing that they'll fill in the gaps with their own knowledge. Oh. So how does he use these techniques to establish Israel's place among the nations?
Well, he starts with Adam, of course, and he moves through Noah and his sons. But then he really narrows the focus to Shem, the ancestor of the Semitic peoples.
It's like he's zooming in. Going from the broadest possible perspective to a more specific focus.
Right.
Zeroing in on the lineage that leads to Israel.
Exactly. And remember that list of 70 nations we talked about earlier?
Yeah.
Well, it comes up again here. Genesis 10 lists precisely 70 nations descended from Noah, and the chronicler makes sure to highlight that connection.
Okay. I'm starting to see the pattern here. The chronicler keeps reinforcing this idea that Israel is part of a divinely ordained order.
Right.
He's weaving them into the very fabric of creation.
Right. And it's not just about numbers. It's about language, too.
Yeah.
The chronicler highlights the name changes of key figures like Abram to Abraham. He even points out that Abraham means exalted father.
He's unpacking the deeper meaning behind these names. It's like he's saying, look, even their names point to Israel's destiny. It's all part of God's plan.
Yes. And he does the same thing with Esau and Seir. He links them both to the color red, connecting them to the land of Edom, which, as you may know, was often seen as a rival to Israel.
So even in these seemingly simple details, he's building a complex picture of Israel's relationship to the world around them, their place in the grand scheme of things.
Now, after establishing this broader context, he finally arrives at Israel itself. He lists the sons of Jacob, but significantly, he uses the name Israel instead of Jacob.
Why is that distinction so important to the same person, right?
It's a subtle but powerful shift. The name Jacob evokes the patriarch's personal struggles and flaws, but Israel represents the nation, the covenant people who will inherit God's promises.
It's like he's saying, we're not just descendants of a man named Jacob. We are the people of Israel chosen by God for a special purpose.
Exactly. And this leads us into the heart of the chronicler's message, the story of David and the establishment of the Davidic dynasty.
And of course, the temple.
Yes. But before we get to David and the temple, let's talk about one more fascinating detail that you brought up in your research. It's about the different types of genealogies the chronicler uses. What are segmented genealogies?
From what I understand, segmented genealogies focus on specific families and trace their lineage in more detail.
That's right. It's like switching from a wide-angle lens to a close-up shot. He's focusing on the intricate details of a particular family line. And in this case, he uses this technique to highlight the lineage of David.
And why is that so important for his audience in Yehud?
Remember, they were living under the rule of Persian kings. There were people longing for a return to their former glory, and the Davidic line represented a hope for the future, a belief that God's promises to David would ultimately be fulfilled.
So even though the present was bleak, the chronicler was offering a vision of hope rooted in their past.
And this hope was centered on the temple for the chronicler. The temple wasn't just a building.
It was the embodiment of God's presence among his people, a symbol of their covenant relationship.
It was the heart of their faith, their identity, their hope for the future, which brings me to a question that's been on my mind. What did the temple actually look like in the chronicler's time? Was it the same grand structure that Solomon built?
That's where things get really interesting. The temple that the chronicler was familiar with was actually the second temple, built after the Babylonian exile. It was considerably more modest than Solomon's grand structure. So is he being a bit creative with his descriptions?
You could say that he describes the temple and its rituals as if they were established by David himself, even though some of those details reflect practices that developed much later.
It's like he's projecting his own vision of an idealized temple back onto David's time.
Exactly. And this tells us something crucial about the chronicler's purpose. He's not just trying to record history accurately. He's using history to shape the identity and beliefs of his audience.
He's crafting a narrative that reinforces their religious practices and bolsters their sense of community.
And for this community, the temple was the most potent symbol of their identity. It represented their connection to their ancestors, their covenant with God, and their hope for a future restoration of Davidic rule.
So by focusing on the temple, the chronicler is essentially saying, this is who we are, this is what we stand for.
Precisely, and that message resonated deeply with his audience. It gave them a sense of purpose and belonging in a time of uncertainty and upheaval.
Yeah, it's incredible how he weaves together history, genealogy, and even numbers to create this powerful narrative about identity and belonging. He's reminding his audience that even though their present circumstances are really difficult, their past gives them hope for the future. And the center of that hope is the temple.
Yeah, and the temple serves as this tangible link to their heritage. You know, it's almost like he's saying, look, we may be living under foreign rule, but we still have this connection to God, this sacred space that defines who we are.
And thinking about it now, it's really striking how relevant this message feels even today. You know, we may not have a physical temple, but we all have those traditions or beliefs or even stories that connect us to something bigger than ourselves.
Absolutely. Whether it's our family history, our cultural heritage, or our religious beliefs, we all draw strength and meaning from those sources. They shape our identity and give us a sense of belonging in the world.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Chronicles, what's the one thing you really want our listener to take away?
I think the key takeaway is that Chronicles is not just some dry historical account. You know, it's a carefully crafted narrative designed to inspire and empower a specific community facing real challenges. And even though that community lived centuries ago, their struggles and aspirations still resonate with us today. It's a reminder that history is never just about the past. It shapes who we are and how we see the world.
It's been so fascinating to see how the chronicler uses these seemingly minor details like genealogies and numbers to create this grand narrative about Israel's identity and purpose. He's reminding his audience who they are, where they came from, and what they stand for.
And, you know, as you continue exploring Chronicles on your own, I encourage you to think about the stories and genealogies that shape your own understanding of who you are. What traditions and beliefs connect you to a larger community? You might be surprised by what you discover.
That's a great thought to leave us with. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Book of Chronicles. We'll see you next time.